When Brad Gordon started the bar fight at the Lucky Lucy Saloon on Pearl Street in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, he hadn't intended to end up in the hospital. The two guys in the tight-fitting plaid shirts with the pointy pearl-button pockets looked like pussies to him, and he figured he could take them easily. There was no way to know they were brothers, not lovers, and they didn't take kindly to his remarks about them. And there was no way to know that the smaller one taught karate at Wyoming State and had won some kind of championship at a Bruce Lee tournament for martial arts in Hong Kong. Kickboxing with metal-tipped cowboy boots, Brad lasted all of 30 seconds, and a lot of his teeth were loose. He had been lying in this fucking infirmary for 3 hours while they tried to push the teeth back in place. There was one periodontist they kept calling, but he wasn't answering, possibly because, as the intern explained, he was off hunting for the weekend because he liked elk. Tasty eating. Elk. Brad's fucking mouth was killing him. So they left him there with ice packs on his face and his jaw shot full of Novocaine, and somehow he fell asleep. And the next morning, the swelling had gone down enough that he could talk on the phone, so he called his attorney, Willie Johnson, in Los Angeles, holding the business card between his bruised thumb and forefinger. The receptionist was cheerful. "Johnson, Baker, and Halloran." "Willie Johnson, please." "Hold on, please." The phone clicked, but he wasn't put on hold, and then he heard the woman say, "Faber, Ellis, and Condon." Brad looked again at the card in his hand. The address was an office building in Encino. He knew what that place was. It was a building where solo attorneys could rent a tiny office and share a receptionist who was trained to answer the phone as if she was working at a big law firm, so clients would not suspect their attorneys were on their own. That building housed only the most unsuccessful sort of attorney, the ones who handled small-time drug dealers, or who had done jail time themselves. "Excuse me," he said into the phone.
"Sorry, sir. I'm trying to find Mr. Johnson for you." She cupped her hand over the phone. "Anybody seen Willie Johnson?"
And he heard a muffled voice yell back, "Willie Johnson is a dick." Sitting there at the entrance to the emergency room, weak and in pain, his jaw aching like hell, Brad did not feel good about what he was hearing.
"Did you find Mr. Johnson?"
"One moment, sir. We're looking..."
He hung up. He felt like crying. He went out to get breakfast, but it hurt too much to eat, and people in the coffee shop looked at him oddly. He saw his reflection in the glass and realized his whole jaw was blue and puffy. Still, it was better than last night. He wasn't worried about anything except this attorney, Johnson. All his initial suspicions about the man were confirmed. Why had they met at a restaurant instead of his law firm? Because Johnson didn't belong to a law firm. There was nothing to do but call his Uncle Jack.
"John B. Watson Investment Group."
"Mr. Watson, please."
They put him through to the secretary, who put him through to his uncle.
"Hey, Uncle Jack."
"Where the fuck are you?"
Watson said. He sounded distinctly unfriendly.
"I'm in Wyoming."
"Staying out of trouble, I hope."
"Actually, my attorney sent me here," he said. "And that's why I'm calling you. I'm a little worried. I mean, this guy..."
"Look," Watson said. "You're up on a molestation charge, and you've got a molestation expert to handle your case. You don't have to like him. Personally, I hear he's a prick."
"Well,
but he wins cases. Do what he says. Why are you talking funny?"
"Nothing."
"I'm busy, Brad, and you were told never to call."
Click.
Brad was feeling worse than ever. Back at his motel room, the guy at the desk said someone from the police had come looking for him. Something about a hate crime. Brad decided it was time to leave beautiful Jackson Hole. He went to his room to pack,
watching some true crime show where the police caught a dangerous fugitive by pretending to put him on television. They staged a fake TV interview set up, and as soon as the guy relaxed, they slapped cuffs on him. And now the guy was on death row. Police were getting tricky. Brad hastily finished packing, paid his bill, and hurried out to his car. The self-proclaimed environmental artist, Mark Sanger, recently returned from a trip to Costa Rica, looked up from his computer in astonishment as four men broke down the door and burst into his Berkeley apartment. The men were dressed head to foot in blue rubber hazmat suits, with big rubber helmets and big faceplates, rubber gloves and boots, and they carried evil-looking rifles and big pistols. He had hardly reacted to the shock when they were on him, grabbing him with their rubber hands and wrestling him away from the keyboard. "Pigs! Fascists!" Sanger yelled, but suddenly it seemed like everybody was shouting and screaming in the room. "This is an outrage! Fascist pigs!" he shouted as they cuffed him, but he could see their faces behind the masks, and they were afraid. "Jesus! What do you think I'm doing here?" he said, and one of them answered, "We know what you're doing, Mr. Sanger," and spun him away. "Hey! Hey!" They pulled him roughly down the steps from his apartment to the street. Sanger could only hope media would be waiting, cameras ready to film this outrage in broad daylight. The press, however, was cordoned off across the street. They could hear Sanger as he shouted, and they were filming him, but their distance prevented the up-close, in-your-face confrontation he hoped for. In fact, Sanger suddenly realized how this scene must look through their lenses. Policemen dressed in frightening hazmat suits escorting a 30-ish bearded man in jeans and a Che Guevara t-shirt who struggled in their arms, cursing and shouting. Sanger knew he must look like a madman, like one of the Teds, Ted Bundy, Ted Kaczynski, one of those guys. The cops would say that he had microbiology equipment in his apartment, that he had tools for genetic engineering, and he was making a plague, making a virus, making a disease, something horrible, a madman. "Put me down," he said, forcing himself to be calm. "I can walk. Let me walk." "All right, sir," one of them said. They let him stand on his feet and walk. Sanger walked with as much dignity as he could muster, straightening his shoulders, shaking his long hair as they led him to a waiting car. Of course, it was an unmarked car. He should have expected that. Fucking FBI or CIA or whatever. Secret government organizations, the shadow government, black helicopters, unaccountable, the crypto-Nazis among us. Fuming, he wasn't prepared to see Mrs. Maloof, the black lady who lived on the second floor of his building, standing outside with her two young kids. As he passed her, she leaned forward and started yelling at him, "You bastard! You risk my family? You risk my children's lives? You Frankenstein! Frankenstein!" Sanger was intensely aware of how that moment would play on the evening news. A black mother shouts at him, calls him Frankenstein, and the kids at her side were crying, frightened by everything that was happening around them. Then the cop shoved Sanger into the unmarked car, with one rubber-gloved hand on his head, easing him into the back seat. And as the door slammed shut, he thought, "I am fucking screwed." Sitting in his jail cell, watching the television in the hallway, trying to hear the commentary over the arguments of the other guys in the cell, trying to ignore the faint smell of vomit and the deep sense of despair that settled over him as he watched. First, there was footage of Sanger himself, hair long, dressed like a bum, walking between two guys in hazmat suits,
He looked even worse than he had feared. The corporate flunky reading the news was mouthing all the buzzwords. Sanger was unemployed. He was an uneducated drifter. He was a fanatic and a loner who had genetic engineering materials in his cramped, filthy apartment, and he was considered dangerous because he fit the classic bioterrorist profile. Next, a bearded San Francisco lawyer from some environmental defense group said Sanger should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Sanger had caused irreparable harm to an endangered species and had jeopardized the very existence of the species by his depredations. Sanger frowned. What the hell was he talking about? Next, the TV showed a picture of a leatherback turtle and a map of Costa Rica. Now it seemed that authorities had been alerted to Sanger's activities because he had visited Tortuguero on the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica sometime before, and because he had made serious threats to the environment regarding leatherback turtles. Sanger couldn't follow this. He had never made any threats. He had wanted to help, that was all. And the fact was, once he got back to his apartment, he had been unable to carry out his plans. He bought stacks of genetics textbooks, but the whole thing was much too complicated. He opened the shortest of the texts and scanned some of the captions to graphics. A plasmid harboring a normal LOXP has little chance of remaining integrated in a genome at a similar LOXP site, since the CRE recombinase will eliminate the integrated DNA fragment. Lentiviral vectors injected into one-cell embryos or incubated with embryos from which zona pellucida was withdrawn were particularly... A more efficient way to replace a gene relies on the use of mutant ES cells devoid of the HPRT gene, hypoxanthine phosphoribosyl transferase. These cells cannot survive in the HAT medium, which contains hypoxanthine, aminoterine, and thymidine. The HPRT gene is introduced at the targeted site by a double homologous recombination. Sanger had stopped reading. And now the TV screen showed turtles on the beach at night glowing a weird purple color. And they thought that he had done that? The very idea was ridiculous. But a fascist state demanded blood for any transgression, real or imagined. Sanger could foresee himself thrown in jail for a crime he hadn't committed, a crime that he didn't even know how to commit. New transgenic pets on horizon, giant cockroaches, permanent pups, artists, industry hard at work. Yale-trained artist Lisa Hensley has joined forces with the genetic firm of Borger and Snod Limited to create giant cockroaches to be sold as pets. The GM cockroaches will be 3 feet long and stand approximately 1 foot off the ground. They will be the size of large dachshunds, says Hensley, although, of course, they won't bark. Hensley regards the pets as works of art intended to raise human awareness of the insect community. The overwhelming majority of living matter on our planet consists of insects, she said. Yet we maintain an irrational prejudice against them. We should embrace our insect brethren, kiss them, love them. She observed that the real danger of global warming is that we may render so many insects extinct. Hensley acknowledged that she was inspired by the work of artist Catherine Chalmers, BS Engineering, Stanford University, whose project American Cockroach first elevated cockroaches to a major theme of contemporary art.
Meanwhile, in suburban New Jersey, the firm of Cumnick Genomics is hard at work creating an animal they believe dog owners really want. Permanent puppies. Cumnick's perma puppies will never grow up, according to spokesperson Lynn Cumnick. When you buy a perma puppy, it stays a puppy forever. The firm is working to eliminate unwanted puppy behavior, such as chewing shoes, which gets on dog owners' nerves. Once the teeth are in, this behavior stops, Cumnick said. Unfortunately, at this point, our genetic interventions have prevented the growth of teeth altogether, but we'll solve that. She said that rumors they were going to market a toothless animal called a gummy dog were untrue. Cumnick observes that since adulthood in human beings is being replaced by permanent adolescence, people naturally wish to be accompanied through life by similarly youthful dogs. Like Peter Pan, we never want to grow up, she says. Genetics makes it possible. Still lost, now driving through very hilly terrain, Stan Milgram squinted at the road sign emerging from the darkness ahead. Palomar Mountain, 37 miles, where the hell was that? He had never realized California was so big. He had passed through a couple of towns a ways back, but at 3 in the morning everything was closed, including gas stations, and then he was once more in dark, empty countryside. He should have brought a map. Stan was exhausted, irritable, and he needed to pull over and sleep. But the damn bird would start shrieking as soon as he stopped the car. Gerard had been silent for the last hour, but now, inexplicably, he began to make telephone dial tones, as if he were calling someone. "Stop it, Gerard," Stan said, and the bird stopped. At least for a moment, Stan was able to drive in silence. But, of course, it didn't last. "I'm hungry," Gerard said.
"You and me both."
"You bring any chips?"
"The chips are gone. They had eaten the last of them back in the town of Earp an hour ago, 2 hours ago. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen," Gerard said, humming.
"Don't do it," Stan warned.
"Nobody knows except Jesus."
"Gerard." Silence. It was like traveling with a child, Stan thought. The bird had all of the stubbornness and unexpectedness of a child. It was exhausting. They passed train tracks off to the right. Gerard made chugging sounds and a mournful whistle.
"I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when."
Stan decided not to say anything. He gripped the wheel and drove through the night. Behind him, he could see a faint lightening of the sky. That meant he was driving west, and that was where he wanted to go, more or less. And then in the tense silence, Gerard began again.
"Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, damen und herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!"
"You're pushing," Stan said, "and I'm giving you a warning."
"It's my life, don't you forget,"
the bird sang, screaming at the top of its lungs. It seemed as if the whole car vibrated. Stan thought the windows might shatter. He winced, gripped the wheel harder, and then the screaming stopped.
"We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight," Gerard said, sounding like an announcer.
Stan shook his head. "Dear God."
"Let's be happy, happy, happy. Say the word now. Happy, happy, happy. Try it somehow."
"Stop," Stan said. Gerard went right on.
"Happy, happy, happy, happy. Oh, baby, yes. Happy, happy."
"That's it," Stan yelled, pulling over to the side of the road. He got out of the car, slammed the driver's door hard.
"You don't scare me, Buster,"
Gerard said. Stan swore and opened the back door. Gerard was singing again. I've got some news for you, and you'll soon find out it's true, and you'll have to eat your lunch all by yourself. No problem, Stan said, because you are out of here, pal. He grabbed the bird roughly. Gerard pecked at him viciously, but he didn't care, and put Gerard down on the side of the road in the dust.
It looks as though you're letting go, and if it's real, I don't want to...
It's real, Stan snarled. Gerard flapped his wings. You can't do this to me, he said. Oh, no. Watch me. Stan walked back to the front of the car, opened the door.
I want my perch, Gerard said. It's the least you can...
Fuck your damn perch!
Don't go away mad. It can't be so bad. Don't go away.
Bye-bye, Gerard! Stan slammed the door and shoved his foot down on the pedal, driving off fast, making sure he raised a big cloud of dust. He looked back, but couldn't see the bird. He did, however, see all the bird shit in the back seat. Jeez, it would take days to clean all that up. But now it was quiet. Blessedly quiet. Finally, the adventures of Gerard were over. Now that there was silence in the car, his accumulated fatigue hit him. Stan began to doze off. He turned on the radio, rolled down the window, stuck his head out in the cold breeze. Nothing was helping. He realized he was going to fall asleep, and he had to pull off the road. That bird had kept him awake. He felt a little bad putting him out in the road that way. It was as good as killing him. A bird like that wouldn't last long in the desert. Some rattler or coyote would make quick work of him, and probably already done it. No reason to go back. Stan pulled over to the side of the road into a grove of pines. He turned the engine off and inhaled the scent of the trees. He fell instantly asleep. Gerard walked back and forth on the dusty ground for a while in the darkness. Apparently, he wanted to get off the ground because several times he tried jumping onto the scrubby sage bushes that surrounded him, but the sage didn't support his weight, and he came crashing down again each time. Finally, he half-hopped, half-flew into the air, coming down again on a juniper bush about 3 feet off the ground. Standing on that makeshift perch, he might have gone to sleep, except the temperature was extremely cold for a tropical bird, and he was kept awake by the yelping of a pack of animals in the desert. The yelps were coming closer. Gerard ruffled his feathers, a sign of unease. He looked in the direction of the sound. He saw several dark shapes moving through the desert brush. He caught the glint of green eyes. He ruffled his feathers again and watched the pack come toward him. The Robinson R-44 helicopter descended in a cloud of dust, and Vasco Borden came out, crouched beneath the blades. He got into the waiting black Hummer. Talk to me, he said to Dolly, who was driving. She'd come down earlier, while Vasco went on that wild goose chase to Pebble Beach. Dolly said, she checked into the Best Western at 7:30 tonight, went to Walston's, where a security guy ID'd the car. She brushed him off with a story about an ex-husband, and he went for it. When was that? Little before 8. From there, she went back to the motel, gave the kid at the desk a story about someone being in her room. While he was checking, she took his shotgun from under the counter and made off with it. Did she? Borden said. The little lady has some balls. Apparently, she had tried to buy a gun in a drugstore but ran into the 10-day wait. And now? We were tracking her cell phone, but she turned it off. Before that happened, we got her heading east toward Ortega Highway. Into the desert, Vasco said, nodding. She'll sleep in her car, and then continue on tomorrow morning. We can download sat shots at 8 a.m. That's the fastest processing time.
She'll be gone before 8 in the morning, Vasco said. He leaned back in the Hummer. She'll go at dawn. So let's see.
He paused, thinking.
All afternoon she's been driving, and it's basically south. The minute all this began, our lady went south.
You thinking Mexico? Dolly said. Vasco shook his head.
She doesn't want to leave a record, and crossing the border will leave a record.
Maybe she'll head east, try to cross at Brown Field or Calexico, Dolly said.
Maybe.
Vasco rubbed his beard thoughtfully. Too late, he felt the mascara coming off on his fingers. Damn, he had to remember that.
She's scared. I think she's heading for a place she thinks will give her help. Maybe meet her father down here. Or meet up with somebody she knows. An old boyfriend, school friend, sorority sister, former teacher, former law partner, something like that.
We've been checking all the net databases for the last 2 hours, Dolly said, and so far we've got nothing.
How about our old phone records?
No calls to San Diego area code.
How far back?
A year. That's all that's available without a special order.
So whoever this is, she hasn't called him in a year.
Vasco sighed.
We'll just have to wait for her. He turned to Dolly. Let's go to that Best Western. I want to find out what kind of gun the little lady got. And we can get a couple of hours rest before dawn. I'm sure we'll get her by tomorrow. I got a feeling.
He tapped his chest.
And I'm never wrong.
Hun, you just got mascara on your nice shirt.
Oh, hell, he sighed.
It'll come out, Dolly said. I'll get it out for you.
Gerard watched the dark shapes approach. They moved with a loping gait and made a snorting or snuffling sound and sometimes a mewling sound. Their bodies were low, their backs were just visible above the sage. They circled his perch, approaching, then sliding away. But they had clearly smelled him because they were coming ever closer to him. There were 6 animals altogether. Gerard ruffled his feathers, partly in an attempt to warm his body. The animals had long snouts. Their eyes glowed bright green. They had a distinctive musky odor that was unpleasant. They had long, fluffy tails. He could see that they were not black, but rather brownish-gray in color. They moved in closer.
I'm shaken. I'm shaken now.
And closer. They were quite close now. The largest one paused a few feet away and stared at Gerard. Gerard did not move. After several seconds, the big animal edged closer.
You can stop right there, mister!
The animal stopped instantly, and even took a few paces backward. The other animals in the group backed away, too. They all seemed confused by the voice. But not for long. The big animal started to move in again.
Well, hold on!
This time there was only a momentary pause. Then the animal kept coming.
You feel lucky, punk? Do ya? Huh?
The animal was coming very slowly now, sniffing at Gerard, closer and closer. Sniff, sniff. The creature smelled awful. The nose was just inches away. Gerard bent and bit hard on the animal's soft nose. The creature yelped and jumped backward, almost knocking Gerard from his perch. He regained his balance.
Every time you turn around, expect to see me, Gerard said, because one time you'll turn around, and I'll be there, and I'll kill you, Matt.
The animal was flat on the ground, rubbing his injured nose with his forelegs. He did that for a while. Then he got up, growling.
Life is hard, but it's harder if you're stupid.
The whole pack of animals was growling now. They moved forward in a semicircle. They seemed to be coordinated.
Gerard ruffled his feathers and ruffled them again. He even flapped his wings, trying to make as large and active a shape of himself as possible. These creatures didn't seem to care.
"Look, you fools! You're in danger, can't you see? They're after you! They're after all of us!"
But the spoken voices seemed to have no effect at all. The animals just kept moving forward slowly. One was loping around behind Gerard. He turned his head to look. Not good. Not good.
"Get back to where you once belonged!"
Gerard flapped his wings again, nervously, but apparently the anxiety gave him new strength, because there was a bit of lift from the branch he stood on. The growling animals closed in. And Gerard flapped his wings hard, hard, and felt himself lift into the air. It was weeks since his last feather clip. That was the reason. He could fly. He moved high above the ground and discovered that he could soar a little. Not much, but a little. The smelly animals were far below, howling at him. But Gerard turned west, following the road that Stan had been driving on. He was heading away from the sunrise toward darkness. With his acute sense of smell, he detected the odor of food and flew toward that. Sleeping in the front seat of her car, Alex Burnett opened her eyes and saw that she was surrounded by men. Three of them were peering into her car. They wore cowboy hats and carried big pronged sticks with loops on them. She sat up abruptly. One of them waved for her to be still.
"Just a moment, miss."
Alex looked over at her son, Jamie, sleeping peacefully in the seat beside her. He didn't awaken. Nothing woke Jamie. When she looked back outside, she gasped. One of the cowboys raised his stick, a gigantic rattlesnake, easily 5 feet long and as thick as a forearm, was wriggling on the end of it, making a sizzling sound with its rattle.
"You can come out now, if you want."
He swung the snake away. She opened the door cautiously.
"It's the heat of your engine," one of them said. "Draws 'em under the car in the mornings."
She saw that there were 6 men altogether. They each had sticks and carried large sacks with squirming contents.
"What are you doing?"
"We're collecting rattlers."
"Why?"
she said. "For the rattlesnake roundup next week in Yuma."
"Uh-huh."
"Do it every year. It's a contest. Who brings the most snakes?"
"I see."
"It's by weight, so you want the biggins. Didn't mean to frighten you."
"Thank you."
The group of men was moving off. The man talking to her lagged behind.
"Ma'am, you oughtn't to be out here alone," he said, "though I see you got yourself a weapon."
He nodded to the back seat of the car.
"Yes," she said, "but I don't have any ammo."
"Well, that won't do you," the man said.
He started toward his car, parked across the road.
"Is that a 12-gauge you got?"
"Yes, it is."
"These'll serve."
He gave her a handful of red shells. She stuffed them into her pockets.
"Thanks. What do I owe you?"
He shook his head.
"You just take care, ma'am."
He turned to rejoin the others.
"A black Hummer came up this road about an hour ago. Big guy with a beard. Said he was looking for a woman and her little boy. Said he was their uncle and they were missing."
"Uh-huh. What'd you tell him?"
"We hadn't seen you yet, so we said no."
"Which way did he go?" she said.
"Toward Elsinore. But I figure any time now he'll be heading back."
"Thanks," she said.
He waved. "Don't stop for gas," he said, "and good luck."
Transcript, CBS 5, San Francisco. Accused bioterrorist released today. CBS 5. Suspected terrorist Mark Sanger was released from Alameda County Jail today on 2 years probation for possession of dangerous biological materials. Informed sources say the technical complexity of the government's charges against Sanger led the prosecutors to reluctantly conclude that they might not be able to put the suspect behind bars. In particular, the charge against Sanger that he had genetically modified turtles in Central America has now been thrown into question. We spoke with Julio Menares in Costa Rica.
It is true that the Atlantic turtles have suffered from genetic modification that produces a purple color in their shells. As yet, there is no explanation for how this happened. But the age of the turtles indicates that genetic manipulation occurred 5 to 10 years ago. Shortly after his arrest, investigators determined that Sanger had not been in Costa Rica early enough to have carried out the genetic change. He was only there last year. And so Mark Sanger, suspected terrorist, is now free on a $500 fine.
In Congressional Hearing Room 443, while waiting for proceedings to begin, Congressman Marvin Minkowski, Democrat Wisconsin, turned to Congressman Henry Wexler, Democrat California, and said,
"Shouldn't we have stronger regulations to limit the availability of recombinant DNA technology?"
"You thinking of Sanger?"
"Well, he's the most recent case. Where did he get his stuff, do you know?"
"On the Internet," Wexler said.
"You can buy recombinant kits from outfits in New Jersey and North Carolina. Cost a couple of $100.
"That's asking for trouble, isn't it?"
"Listen," Wexler said, "my wife gardens."
"Does your wife garden?"
"Now that the kids are gone, she's a fanatic about her roses."
"Local garden club, all of that?"
"Well, sure."
"Plenty of gardeners who used to make hybrids by grafting cuttings onto rootstocks now use DNA kits to carry things a step further," Wexler said. "People are making genetically modified roses all over the world. Supposedly, a Japanese company has made a blue rose using GM methods. A blue rose has been a dream of growers for centuries. Point is, the technology's everywhere, Marv. It's in big companies, and it's in backyards everywhere."
"What do we do about that?" Minkowski said.
"Nothing," Wexler said. "I'm not about to do anything to make your wife angry, or mine."
He cupped his chin in his hand, in a gesture that always looked intelligent on camera.
"But maybe," he said, "maybe it's time for a speech expressing my concern about the dangers of this uncontrolled technology."
"Good idea," Minkowski said. "I think I'll give one, too."